You're listening to WRIR 97.3 LPFM, and this is Open Source RVA. Today on Open Source RVA, we talk with Parker Agelasto, councilman-elect to the city's 5th District, about a range of issues, including the Redskins deal, the fight against blight, Center Stage, and the Richmond Arts Community. And we talk with Alice Lynch, executive director of the Virginia Capital Foundation, about the state capital's very first tourism film. But first, the news. For Open Source RVA, I'm Amy Daniel. The 2012 Governor's Housing Conference started this Wednesday with some promising numbers about homelessness in the state, according to a press release from the office of Governor Bob McDonnell. The release reports that the overall rate of homelessness in Virginia has decreased 8% as per data compiled by the Virginia Department of Housing and Community Development and the Virginia Coalition to End Homelessness, which goes on to state a 36% drop in the number of Virginia residents experiencing chronic homelessness. The Office of the Governor attributes these successes to a shift in focusing resources on getting people into permanent housing sooner as appropriate community services are also drawn on. The housing conference wrapped up this morning. According to the Richmond Registrar's Office, the provisional ballots in last Tuesday's 1st District Council race have been counted, and John Belisle's won by a mere 22 votes over incumbent Bruce Tyler. Because of the close vote tally, an automatic recount will be held next week. The registrar gave the final tally as 6,340 votes for Belisle's and 6,318 votes for Tyler. Election night has been going on for a week now, Belisle's, the son of former Virginia Governor Gerald Belisle's, told the Richmond Times-Dispatch. I guess it's going to last a few more days. This upcoming Tuesday, November 20th, the Central Virginia Transgender Day of Remembrance Memorial Service will be held in the Great Hall at the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Richmond. This is a collaborative event brought to the public by over 30 local organizations that support LGBTQ communities and organized in concert with similar events across the globe to mourn and honor slain transgender men and women. The National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs reports that in 2011, transgender individuals, specifically transgender women, and most specifically transgender women of color, were disproportionately more likely to have been the survivors and victims of hate crimes, and that this is but a continuation of a history of violence against transgender communities. The First UU website emphasized that the service is open to all who long for a day when respect replaces scorn, when love replaces hate, and when understanding replaces fear. The memorial service will be held from 7 to 9 p.m. at the First Unitarian Universalist Church of Richmond in the Bird Park neighborhood this upcoming Tuesday, November 20th. The defeat on November 6th of incumbent 5th District Councilman Marty Jewell was a stunning upset, one of a number of shocking political turnovers on a night of surprises. But even before all the votes were tallied, things already looked dim for Jewell's chances of returning to council. As he awaited those final returns, Jewell spoke with Open Source RVA about worries that his challenger, Parker Agelasto, may not have what it takes to represent the district, and about his own suspicion that Agelasto might be carrying water not for voters, but for Jewell's political enemy, Mayor Dwight C. Jones.
We're looking at the. I guess these are early returns still. How are you feeling right now? It's looking like you're down by a bit.
I'm hearing that I'm trailing. The two unreported precincts, one of them is Maymount, which is a major numbers typically coming out of that precinct.
What do you think? What do you think this is telling of? You're right now, we're looking at the numbers, and it's 50-40%, with about 10% going to Lee. So she might be sort of the game changer. But what do you think what would you owe this switch up to?
It is very clear that the mayor has led an effort to unseat me. And he's pulled out all stops in doing so.
You've been one of his most vocal opposition members of council over the last 4 years.
All right.
You've stepped.
That's true.
and had some pretty significant clashes with him. Is your relationship strained with him on a political personal level, or is he?
I, 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 I have no issue with the mayor as long as he follows what I've always asked of anyone else, and that is if you're going to do it right. When it's not done right, I raise concern.
Some of the concerns you've been raising are what? You've got the city stadium issue, right?
Absolutely. I felt that he was going behind my back and negotiating the sale of a city venue that would impact my constituents, and that should not have been a secret.
Now, and this is not, I guess, something that would be unheard of with the Jones administration. We just recently saw the West Hampton School is now part of a deal for the Redskins coming here, and it was a deal that was unknown to the constituency
which
in that area.
Also is being done in secret.
Right. Bruce Tyler had said that he knew nothing of that deal, and in fact, just a few days before the deal was announced, Bon Secours had said that nothing was going on with the school, right?
The mayor has a 5 votes, if not 6, in his pockets. He can do pretty much as he pleases. But again, he doesn't dishonor me or Bruce Tyler or anyone else. He dishonors the city by not going according to law and protocol.
Now, a council.
We've not been briefed on any of these matters. That's the problem. We don't get information.
Okay, so with Connor potentially losing his race as well, or very most certainly losing his race as well, we're looking at a lot more or a lot fewer opposition voices on council. How is that going to affect the citizens, you think?
Well, Mr. Connor certainly never gave any opposition. Mr. Connor was one of the votes in the mayor's pocket.
But he,
it looks like he got double-crossed.
But he would occasionally vote with your block, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Very rare.
But what does the city face with, I guess, a council without the stronger opposition voices?
The city is faced with a mayor who wants to run the city like he runs his church, by dictate. That's how he's always operated. He loves to amass power. And when he does, he uses it to advance self, a handful of friends, and the rest of y'all be damned.
Now, are you?
I don't cherish what the city is about to go through.
Parker Agelasto comes to us as something of a blank canvas. The 36-year-old adjunct professor and consultant has never been involved in city politics and has never held political office. Unlike the incumbent that he beat out for his seat, his style is low-key and personal, anything but bombastic and showy. Agelasto won the 5th District City Council seat in last week's election by going door-to-door and meeting hundreds of constituents face-to-face, and by running a disciplined and highly organized campaign. His place on council is also something of an anomaly in a town which has seen a steady stream of leaders who pay lip service to the town's blossoming arts community while often ignoring or totally disregarding the input of actual artists and arts administrators. But Agelasto is a museum consultant. One of his degrees is in art history, making him the first council person in the modern era with a genuine arts background. But who is Parker Agelasto? Is he the man that his opponent, Marty Jewell, portrayed during the campaign as kind of an instant rubber stamp for Mayor Dwight Jones? Or is he something else, a new kind of city leader with a different perspective and few concrete alliances? To help us answer those questions, I'm joined today by the new 5th District Representative, Parker Agelasto. Welcome to Open Source RVA.
Thanks, Don.
First of all, give us a little of your background. Where are you from originally?
I was born in Virginia Beach, grew up there with a large family, and went on to college in Maine. Wanted to get a little bit of a diverse background experience there, and came back to live in Washington, D.C., and work for the Smithsonian for 4 years before going to graduate school in Charlottesville, where, as you mentioned, I did get my master's in art history at the University of Virginia while simultaneously earning an MBA from the Darden Business School.
Wow. What drew you to run for city council? What was it?
The fact that we have a great city, the fact that so many people constantly talk about the potential that we have this arts community, and a lot of young people have been moving here, but we seem to have old-style leadership. We don't have something, someone on council who is representing this new population. I wanted to make sure that we had somebody who was very sensitive to Richmond's history, who could understand where Richmond comes from, and the real kind of challenges that set many of our residents' perceptions on where the city is and where we're going, but also this new breed of people who've moved here. And they don't know necessarily the history. And you have to kind of provide a bridge. And as somebody who's a historian, who's also a come here, you know, a 36-year-old who's been here for almost 7 years, I felt that I was in a good position to offer that bridge.
To some people, you just came out of nowhere to win your race, but you actually raised more money than Marty Jewell, the incumbent. Is that correct?
I believe so.
And you also won some big endorsements. How important was the endorsement from the Richmond City Democratic Committee?
It definitely is important. Any endorsement you get gives you credibility. It says these people believe in you, and they think you're going to be the better candidate. But at the same time, an endorsement doesn't cast a vote on election day. So it's the voters who determine the value of the endorsements. I think various endorsements, I received that from the city committee for the Democratic Party, also from the Coalition of Police, the Times-Dispatch. So you can kind of figure out, all right, were those endorsements key? Or my opponents received endorsements from the realtors, from the educators, from the Crusade for Voters, from different groups. And so you have to kind of judge for yourself what the makeup was and how influential some of those endorsements might have been to voters.
And one of the things that Mr. Jewell kept saying throughout the campaign was that if you won, you would just be an instant rubber stamp for whatever came out of the Jones administration. Address that a little bit. Are you closely aligned with Mayor Jones?
I think what that represented was Marty Jewell's continual attacks against the mayor. You know, he had to represent the same line of thought that he had been representing for the last few years as a vocal critic of the mayor. My supposed alliance with the mayor never existed. It's one of those of I got my petition signed in a 24-hour period to make the ballot. I was the one walking door to door. I was the one raising the money. I'm sure if you looked at the mayor's list of donors and my list of donors, there's probably very little that overlap.
Actually, I did, and there wasn't much.
Did you? So, and it's funny because Marty carried that line of attack the whole duration. And it wasn't until maybe 2 weeks before the election that Style Weekly covered an article and compared the two styles. And Marty came out and said, well, I was, quote unquote, the mayor's minion. Well, the mayor's staff said, hey, let's meet. You know, apparently
we have a minion. I didn't know that.
Apparently we have a coalition that we didn't know existed. But as that was kind of Marty's unofficial endorsement of the mayor for me, I did talk to the mayor, and that was our first sit down.
Well, I guess it's a fair question. What do you think of the mayor? What do you think of his achievements? And has he been a good mayor, Mayor Dwight Jones?
My experience in Richmond, and I can only compare Mayor Jones to Mayor Wilder, and that's just my experience. And frankly, I was not a big fan of Mayor Wilder's style. I thought that the confrontations with the school board, the grandstanding in many ways was over the top and not necessarily moving the city forward.
What about his ultimate point, though, that he was making? What about Wilder's point that some of these institutions, particularly our schools administration, needed some shaking up? Forget the way he went about it.
I would agree. I mean, we clearly have to do something about our schools. And that was one of the main things that I campaigned on. But it all goes down to style.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if you draw the battle lines, you're not really going to be able to work together.
Mm.
And that's problematic because everybody is invested in what's happening with our schools. If you disagree, you got to find what's the common ground to move forward with instead of constantly just saying, well, it's my way or the highway.
Right.
Mayor Jones compared to Mayor Wilder is a much quieter individual.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes so quiet that you're not quite sure where he stands on certain positions. And that was one of the things that I was particularly concerned going into the election with the state of the city stadium and where were the Redskins going.
Right.
And when you don't know anything, you just have to say, well, if I were in his seat, this is what I would try to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I certainly was hoping for more communication, particularly on that deal.
Right. Well, articulate your view of that deal, because that's a very controversial subject, as you know. A lot of different opinions on that.
The Redskins coming to Richmond is a great thing for Richmond. You know, it's going to put Richmond on the map and bringing people here. The economic impact study that Chamora did, I'm not quite sure I believe the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
I've looked at enough of these types of reports.
Yeah, a lot of those reports are pay for play, really. They're sort of conclusions that are already reached in many cases. Was it that kind of a study?
I can't answer whether it was that kind of a study, but it the numbers to me just didn't seem to add up.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not to diminish the fact that the Redskins will have an economic impact for Richmond.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people should be excited about that. I think particularly people in the 5th District should be excited. Carytown is going to benefit greatly from the proximity.
Right.
Our restaurants in Uptown and in Oregon Hill are going to benefit greatly from more tourists coming to this city who spend the night and dine out. I think that's fantastic.
What's the first thing that you hope to tackle when you get on council, when you sit in the seat?
It really goes to what I witnessed on the ground. When you walk as much as I did during the campaign and you see as many vacant homes and blighted properties and the crime that is associated with this, it's the number one concern of our district residents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think the city schools are the number one concern of all the city. But in terms of the 5th District, the number of vacant homes is really problematic. And I'd love to create an inventory.
Mm-hmm.
And from that inventory, determine, do we have repeat offenders? Are there large property owners who are sitting on 20 and 30 of these homes and not doing anything?
Well, we already know about many of them, and they are. So the problem's been around for a while.
Right. And so it's working with the General Assembly to see what the city can actually do legally, because Virginia is a state in which our laws favor the property owners.
Mm-hmm.
But D.C., Richmond has a lot of rental units.
Mm-hmm.
And when I lived in D.C., which also had a lot of rental units, D.C. had something called a tenant's bill of rights, so that the renters had some leverage with the property owners.
Right.
And I sit there and I think, well, can D.C. become an analogy for Richmond, though Virginia's laws are slightly different?
Mm-hmm.
You just have to investigate it and see whether or not we can do something to alleviate the burden that the neighborhoods currently feel.
Right. Well, you also spoke during the campaign about the issue of parking in the city, or rather the lack of parking. How do you hope to address that problem?
Again, particularly around VCU, when you've got the fan who is currently paying residents or having to pay to park on the streets in front of their homes, Oregon Hill's been debating whether they have to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Randolph is beginning to see this similar creep effect. Again, it goes to working with the General Assembly.
Mm-hmm.
The VCU parking garages are part of the state jurisdiction, and I believe currently VCU must earn revenue on the parking garages in order to pay for the bonds. And that's just the relationship that the state has with the university. So you sit there and you have to say, well, can that relationship change?
Mm-hmm.
If VCU opened up their parking garages and there could be some subsidy so they didn't have to charge the rates that they charge, more people would park in the decks instead of on the streets.
Right.
But again, it goes back to the state and just understanding what the state regulations are and whether they would be willing to accommodate the citizens of Richmond.
Mm-hmm. You also spoke during the campaign about crime and public safety, which I think you said was a particular problem right now in the 5th District. How will you address that? That seems to be a problem that comes and goes in the city.
One is having a close relationship and communication with the various precincts. In the 5th District, we've got the 3rd Precinct that covers most of the north side of the river. We've got the 2nd Precinct that covers much of our south side of the river. The 4th Precinct covers Oregon Hill downtown area. And then, of course, VCU Police. So you have to make sure that you're in good communication with all of these divisions of our law enforcement so that we can inform the citizens. You know, mm-hmm. I see city council members really having a leadership role in communicating mm-hmm. Safety and mm-hmm. making sure that people realize when there are criminal events in the neighborhood that our citizens are informed about how to protect themselves.
Right.
The other thing, and this is just walking the neighborhood again, mm-hmm. when it started to get dark in the fall, you see how many of the homes do not leave an exterior light on. You know, that's
so something as simple as that.
Something as simple as leaving an exterior light on can help reduce crime.
Right, right.
And there are a number of homes that don't even have that lamp to turn on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And can we work with the property owners to suggest, can you install this and have something so that there's a little bit more light for the residents when they're walking in the evenings?
Mm. Well, I'm not sure how much you got into this on the campaign trail, but Richmond's water hookup rate is by far the highest in the nation. And many have argued that the fee unduly affects poor people and the elderly. And up until now, City Hall has really not addressed this. Do you think that this is a high priority?
It is. I know that Scott Berger, who's a constituent in the 5th District, mm-hmm. Has been...
Yeah, I know you've heard from him.
he's been talking about this for a number of years.
Yeah.
And I think it wasn't until this election cycle that people really took note of what Scott had to say. And mm-hmm. it was all gamuts of the city saying, oh my gosh, really?
Well, when he challenged people, like Open Source RVA, he challenged us to find a higher rate in the nation, and we couldn't find one. I think that was kind of eye-opening, really.
So I've talked to Scott, and I've talked to a number of constituents, and I certainly would like to reduce the base rate
mm-hmm.
For our city water, the hookup fee,
right.
But to modify our usage fee, because I do think if you actually pay for your consumption, you're going to moderate and determine is that as much water as you need to use.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people just turn on the spigot and let it flow because it's not costing them that much money.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can improve water conservation, I think that's going to be a great sustainable initiative for our city citizens.
We'll be back with more of our interview with Parker Agelasto, including his thoughts on center stage, regional cooperation, and the nagging problem of potholes. You're listening to Open Source RVA.
WRIR's programming is generously supported by the Richmond office of the law firm of Kaufman & Knowles. Kaufman & Knowles, Richmond lawyers serving the needs of Richmond business. For further information, 804-771-5715 or www.kaufmanandknowles.com. Broadcast of WRIR is made possible in part by VCU Arts and the Virginia Center for Architecture, ica.vcu.edu.
If Virginia's story ever were committed in full to the silver screen, only an all-star ensemble cast of the biggest names could do justice to the sprawling epic that is our history. And even then, Hollywood likely would run short of star power to fill out the credits. Until Spielberg steals his director's nerve to tackle that project, we'll have to make do with Keepers of the Flame, an amazingly thorough effort to condense the whole 400-year saga into 20 or so minutes, produced by the Virginia Capital Foundation. I'm with Alice Lynch. She's the executive director of the Virginia Capital Foundation, and she has overseen the production of the state's very first tourism movie, Keepers of the Flame.
Well, it's the very first visitor film for the Virginia State Capitol, yes.
And this is many years in the making, from my understanding?
Many years in the making. We first had the idea back in 2006, and it took us some time to raise the money. And then ultimately, when we got into production, we had many, many months of script development and fact-checking and then shooting.
And it just premiered, what, maybe a month ago?
About a month ago, in the fall of 2012, October 2012.
And I got to see it, and it was really good.
Oh, well, thank you. I hope everyone has that reaction.
Yeah, in fact, you guys, I guess you rolled out the real red carpet, and you had the light strobe lights going down by the Capitol building for a big gala.
And this was not a Steven Spielberg production, so we didn't quite roll out that red carpet. But nevertheless, we had a really wonderful evening with all of the filmmakers and sponsors and others who made it possible, and it was an all-Virginia effort.
Now, you said it was a few years ago. What was the impetus for doing the film? I remember during your introduction of the film that there was a little bit of a talk of other states having these, and it was sort of an oversight that Virginia did not yet. Why did you guys decide you needed one?
Well, when the Virginia Capital Foundation was formed, we were given a few important charges, historic preservation being one of them. Our capital dates back to 1788, designed by Thomas Jefferson, and so there are components of it that are more than 200 years old. So preservation was something on our radar. Art acquisition, specifically our first initiative in that area was a brand new statue of Thomas Jefferson, which now graces the Capitol. And then lastly, the enhancement of educational programs. We already have a very able guide staff that takes through about 100,000 visitors a year.
The docents.
The docents, yes. We call them Capitol guides.
Sorry. Some of them seem to like docents.
No, they used to be called hostesses.
Hostesses.
Yes,
okay.
But now they're a professional trained group of guides. And the foundation knew that we wanted to maintain the emphasis on a personal guided tour. That was important. So we thought, what can we do to enhance that? And one thought that immediately came to mind was a film. As you mentioned, many other capitals have a visitor film. We did not. And our board members and the legislative leaders agreed that it was about time.
Now, the film itself, again, you said it took some time to do some fundraising for this, and I recall a figure, it was a little bit more than $1 million, right, that was the total cost of production for this film. So it's not a low-budget bunch of B-roll or something. This was a high production value production.
Absolutely. And that cost includes absolutely everything from the very beginning of the whole program to the installation of equipment. And
the whole thing, the
yes.
Kit caboodle. I mean, watching it really did feel like you were, I mean, it's not, obviously, again, it's not Spielberg. It's not 2.5 hour epic on Abraham Lincoln. But what it is what, about 22 minutes?
It is. It's 22 minutes.
That somehow manages to span 400 years or more?
And it was a daunting task, knowing that we had to cover all of Virginia history. So in looking at that expanse of very rich and involved history, we decided, okay, how can we focus this film so that we really can accomplish a meaningful goal in 20 minutes?
Well done, by the way.
Thank you. I think so. I'm a little bit biased, but it brought tears to our eyes when we saw it on the screen, probably for many reasons, but mostly because it is a very moving story.
It definitely had that sort of chill factor to it. Can you talk a little bit about how you managed to condense all of that information into such a tight space? I mean, of course, I've seen it, so I can sort of talk a little bit about it, but it was really neat the way that you, I think, sort of took this thread of Keepers of the Flame, the title of the film, I guess had various figures in Virginia history sort of becoming a part of that thread, keeping the flame alight.
Yes.
So how did you, I mean, was that an original part of the narrative concept, or was that something that developed later on as?
Well, as we were looking at that 400 years of history, and Virginia really plays a central role in the American story from the very beginning of Jamestown through many of the momentous historical events in the 20th century. So how do we narrow that? And we decided, because it's a film at the Capitol, where the oldest English-speaking legislative body in the Western Hemisphere is still doing the people's business, yes, we would focus on that. And it's not specifically a story about government, but it is a story about civic service and individuals who have stepped up either in elected roles or appointed roles or just as citizens to make a difference, to help us tell that Virginia story and ultimately the American story.
What I thought was great about it was you have very few individuals who are spotlighted. Obviously, you have a few. You have Thomas Jefferson, who narrates portions of it, but it does a really nice job, I thought, of sort of giving you the essence of many Virginians and many significant Virginians and their effort to keep the flame alight and to move Virginia forward without, I guess, focusing on single individuals, somebody like a Patrick Henry, or and getting bogged down in, you know, personal stories. So that was a really good...
It's hard to find the right words.
Was there anybody you felt like, oh gosh, we've got to get this person in there?
Well, it was a real challenging task, again, facing 20 minutes. And what that does is it really makes you focus on the story that you want to tell and how best to tell it. Sometimes it's easier to talk about what the film isn't. It isn't all of Virginia history. There are other entities that do that very well. It isn't the top 10 Virginians, because goodness knows, I would never want to try to craft such a list. It would be just filled with all kinds possible pitfalls.
It's many books down at the Library of Virginia.
Yes. There were stories that we knew we wanted to tell. We knew we needed to talk about the Virginia-born presidents, Virginia being mother of presidents.
Sure.
George Washington, obviously top of that list. Jefferson was a natural to narrate the story because he designed our building. And with Bill Barker from Colonial Williamsburg portraying him, he really brings that figure to life. And a story that concludes the film, the story of Barbara Johns, was also one that we knew from the beginning that we wanted to include for so many reasons.
And real quick, Barbara Johns, of course, led a walkout.
Yes.
In
Prince Edward County.
Mm-hmm. And this was pre-civil rights movement, or I guess at the very beginning of the civil rights movement. This was one of the cases that was brought together to be Brown v. Board.
Yes, yes. And it's a story that is still surprising to so many people. They don't know it, because we know about Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know that Virginia had one of the five cases that formed that Supreme Court case, that landmark case.
And in fact, Johns herself was, I mean, in many ways, she really was a rallying figure.
Yes.
And is almost sort of, well, she's certainly a keeper of the flame. She's
yes.
kind of a patriot in many ways. She took up the mantle and
yes.
and moved forward.
And helped us to progress the flame of liberty, which is the flame that we are keeping.
Referring to.
And the beauty of the Barbara Johns story, again, there's so many positive angles to it, but the fact that she's a school kid, she's a student at the Moton School in Prince Edward County, and she leads her students, and indeed the whole community, to protest the conditions of the school. They didn't want desegregation. They just wanted a good school,
mm-hmm.
one where they could learn and not be distracted by the condition of the building. It's an amazing story.
I think that's why Oliver Hill and Spotswood Robinson identified that as one of the cases that they wanted to pick up, too, as I recall, is that it was a case that was just about wanting a good school.
Yes, yes. And it's a wonderful story. When we share it, either on a tour of the Capitol Square grounds where there is a monument to this movement. And now, as we bring her to life in the film, I firmly believe that it's a story that will speak to all ages, but particularly to school children, knowing that their civic service starts now,
yeah,
and they can make a difference even now.
Now, this film, again, started running in October, late October, and any idea what your audiences have been so far in terms of numbers? Or I guess you guys know that you have thousands that come through the Capitol every year.
We hope that people will come to the Capitol to see the film.
So you're hoping this will generate an additional bit of traffic?
Yes. So in addition to the foundation's efforts at art acquisition and historic preservation and education, we also see economic development as an important part of what we do. The Capitol is the front door of Virginia, and it already attracts well more than 100,000 visitors a year who come specifically to see Jefferson's temple and the Udon Statue of Washington. We want even more to come to see this film and to actually walk in the footsteps of those depicted in the film and the other greats who served there in the Virginia State Capitol.
Now, again, the film is free?
Yeah, absolutely.
The Capitol is free?
Always. There will never, ever be a charge to tour our Capitol.
Are free?
Yes, the grounds. And it is actually important to note that Capitol Square is one of the oldest enclosed public parks in our nation.
The whole thing is free. How do you lose, right?
You're right.
Except for lunch at whatever the newly constituted chicken.
Lunch at Merriweather's is the best deal in town.
Right. It's not chickens anymore.
It is not chickens, and it's delightful. I eat there every day.
Wonderful. All right. Thank you very much. Again, I'm here with Alice Lynch. She is the executive director of the Virginia Capitol Foundation, and we're talking about Keepers of the Flame, the state's brand new capitals, brand new tourism video film. It's not a video, it's a film. Fifth District Councilman-elect Parker Agelasto may well be uniquely qualified to advocate for a segment of the Richmond community that is increasing in prominence. As a museum consultant and adjunct professor of art history at UVA, he stands to be a strong advocate for the Richmond arts community. Here's part two of our open-source RVA interview with Agelasto.
How will your experience in the arts world help you in your new position as a council person? You're a museum consultant, is that correct?
That's correct. I think it's going to be great for this city, particularly since we've got...
It'll be new.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly new, but when you start looking at the number of museums that are located inside the city, that's one of the big cultural and tourist attractions for why people come to Richmond. Having an understanding of those metrics is important. But also knowing the people who work there, and a lot of people who work at the museums and cultural heritage areas live inside the city,
mm-hmm.
Particularly when you start talking about the arts sector. The arts, people who work in the arts are some of the most progressive thinkers.
Right.
You know, and they...
It doesn't seem like we tap into that enough in city politics, it seems like, to me.
Well, there's a large percentage of the population that certainly looks at progressive values.
Mm-hmm.
But are we doing enough of that in city council on the leadership levels? You know, I think we could probably do a little bit better.
What are your feelings about Richmond's new arts district? As you know, there are opinions on both sides. Some people say it's way too big and is not a true arts district in the way that it was meant to be set up. What are your feelings on it, and is it an arts district in name only?
So the way that they set it up, it allows for additional arts districts to populate throughout the city. Clearly, the one we're talking about right now is the Broad Street, Jackson Ward.
Mm-hmm.
The downtown, we've got additional spaces in Manchester that, you know, at some point they might say they're an arts district. We've got Uptown and all the galleries that are located there with VCU. Oh, well, maybe they should be an arts district.
Main Street.
The with Visual Arts Center, exactly. The thing that I think was really driving that conversation is economic development,
mm-hmm.
and creating a district and an incentive associated with that district to bring in new businesses. Mm-hmm. That's really what the driving force was there. And that's essentially what art districts in other cities have tried to do. So all it was to set parameters to try and encourage more businesses, and hopefully they're going to be related to the arts. But I'm not quite sure that the incentives are tied to bringing a new gallery or bringing a new artist studio space. Mm-hmm. I think it's a district.
Right. Well, Richmond's meals tax is one of the highest in the state and indeed of the region. We also have an admissions tax that some feel restricts the entertainment that comes into the area. Will you work to lower these taxes, or do you think that these rates should stay where they are?
The meals tax is of particular issue because it was tied to the Center Stage.
Right.
And I think Center Stage has opened, and it's got its programs. It's perhaps not doing as well as the forecast had said it would do.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't do much about the fact that the forecasts were wrong.
But you can do something about not giving them more and more and more money.
You can look at whether or not the meals tax today should still be at the rate that it is.
Right, because actually when it was passed, the city council said it was going to be temporary, and then once it was in place, it was not temporary, it was permanent.
Right, and you certainly want your restaurants in the city to be competitive. And if we have a higher tax rate on our meals, and somebody can go to Hanover, Henrico, Chesterfield counties and not pay that, mm-hmm. you know, you're talking a few dollars, but if you eat out regularly, that adds up. What I think is the most unusual right now is the fact that you're seeing Henrico debate whether or not to add a meals tax, to give them the rights to charge a meals tax in Henrico County. So if you talk about kind of neutralize the playing field mm-hmm. with the city and the counties, you know, sure, the city might come down a little bit, which I would certainly recommend. But if the counties start coming up to meet us, you know, that's a great
Maybe
thing.
Maybe we'll have an advantage soon.
Then we might have the advantage, exactly.
Well, your predecessor called giving control of the Landmark Theater to the Center Stage Foundation the deal of a lifetime. Do you agree?
I'm not sure I know enough about the finances. What I understand is the Landmark was financially successful.
Mm-hmm.
Center Stage is still struggling. And by combining assets like this, you're basically, you know, robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Right.
And maybe there's going to be synergies that make both do better.
Mm-hmm.
That would certainly be the goal of the combination. But until I have a chance to actually look at what is going to happen, you just can't say.
Well, we're told that the figure there is $14 million in public money, but actually it's more than double that when you consider the state and historic tax credits, and also the fact that we gave away the naming rights. As someone involved in the arts, speak to that a little bit. It seems like the city's not really telling us the full story of what's going on there.
So on naming rights, and I just want to put this out because I seem to be the only person who's out there talking about this,
okay.
but forever and ever, the museum world, just as in higher education, that they sell a lot of these naming rights.
Mm-hmm.
They never, ever understand. I've been a proponent of leasing the naming rights.
Mm-hmm.
You give a 10-year naming rights deal, and you get your chunk of money.
Mm-hmm.
Then in the next 10 years, you go back out there, and you ask who wants to buy the naming rights for the next 10 years. It might be the same donor.
Right,
but it allows you to have future revenues associated with the same fixed asset.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to build a new building in order to get another naming rights. You don't have to build a new gallery to get more naming rights. And that's something that I've always proposed, but it just doesn't ever seem to get any traction within the museum
world.
Well,
especially if the people within the city aren't really being forthcoming in the fact that this is basically revenue that's not being raised for the city. You're basically giving it up.
The naming rights.
Yeah, the naming rights.
I think the way that a lot of people look at naming rights is that it's supposed to be extra money, but it's really paying for the bricks and mortar. You know, so the money from Altria is basically going into the bricks and mortar of the renovation.
Well, because you're in the arts world, I want to ask, should our two most prominent performing arts venues, the Carpenter and the Landmark, have been placed in the hands of a private foundation run by people with essentially no arts presentation experience? Was that an oversight?
I think you certainly need people who are qualified to manage both institutions, both of the Landmark and the Carpenter Center. Without qualifications, you know, you've got the blind leading the blind. The challenge that I see is there's an attempt for efficiencies, and I support any attempts to get efficiencies, mm-hmm. but they have to be well-informed. You have to know what those efficiencies are that you're going to gain.
Right.
And I think what I have seen is without an arts background in the decision-making process, the forecasts were never called into question.
Mm-hmm.
The metrics and the benchmarks weren't well enough understood by those making a determination to ask the important questions.
Mm-hmm.
So at this stage, I think it's great to have somebody on city council who knows how the cultural arts work.
Right.
And to provide not a voice for the arts, but advice for the arts.
Right, an understanding.
An understanding, exactly.
Well, the rents at Center Stage are so high that many local performing arts groups can't even afford to host events there, and some of the venues within the structure have serious technical deficiencies. For instance, there's a black box theater there that you can't move scenery in and out of. As an arts administrator, how serious are those kinds of problems to the long-term success of the venue?
One of the other problems was the scheduling. You know, originally you could have multi events scheduled at the same time, and currently I don't think that they're scheduling multiple events in the different spaces all
right.
at the same time. I think
right.
it's one event at the same time. And from my understanding is because of that, the number of security and other staff members that have to be there
mm-hmm.
just to open up the facility have prohibited some of our smaller groups to perform. And it's sad when you see the Shakespeare group go to St. Catherine's School.
Right.
It's sad to, you know, think.
Well, there are many of those groups
that Henley,
never,
yeah,
yeah,
Henley
that have never even been in there that were, you know, lobbying for the funding of the venue that never even went in there, like the Richmond Jazz Society,
mm-hmm.
Basically because it's so expensive.
Mm-hmm.
City leaders, including the mayor, love to name drop the creative class theory whenever they justify decisions relating to the arts. What, in your mind, is that theory? What is the creative class theory?
In that Richard Florida book.
In the
book.
Richard Florida, yes.
The
yes.
Richard
in fact,
Florida's
we even
book.
Invited Richard Florida to come, a much-hyped appearance where he explained himself. But it seems like now everyone uses it to justify just about anything that's related to the arts.
I don't think it's necessarily having to relate to the arts,
mm-hmm.
but what it
but
is...
But in particular, it's normally used in that sense.
Right. I think what it exemplifies is a coming together of people who are broad-minded, who have vast experiences that are different,
mm-hmm.
and are willing to share those ideas, who are willing to learn from others. And I see that as something that is part of progressive values. I see that as something that the younger population really understands as they start to take from other cultures
mm-hmm.
these elements that they want to apply to their own lifestyle,
right.
even though they may not descend from that particular culture. It's
mm-hmm.
something that they have appropriated.
Right.
And you see that more and more in the city of Richmond and the fact that we have such a diverse and very heterogeneous society developing.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be the creative class to me.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of where that goes, I think it also signifies people who are willing to step out of a comfort zone,
mm-hmm.
people who are willing to take risks and stand up for those issues that they believe in. And I see that happening on a regular basis in Richmond. It may not necessarily be related to this gallery or this artist
mm-hmm.
or this museum,
mm-hmm.
but it's the chefs. You know, it's people who create. It's these people who are artists in whatever profession they've chosen.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me that if we really embrace the creative class theory, we would have been doing more, say, for an event like First Fridays, than we would building these huge kind of booster-driven structures like the convention center and center stage. But the city really didn't have much to do with First Fridays. Do you think that was an oversight? And do you think that there's a place for this city to help with these grassroots arts initiatives that have now proven that they can help rejuvenate downtown and do so much for our city?
When you talk about the creative class, a lot of it is organic. You know, this is just the coming together of people. Mm-hmm. And these things happen because one person has an idea and five people like that idea and they want to help that one person. Mm-hmm. I think that's what we've seen so much. That's community engagement. Whether you're trying to get the community in Swansboro together to do something or you're trying to get the community in Carytown to do something, it's the same initiatives. It's just how you go about it, it's the same, right?
Right.
I think when you get the city involved and the city wants to take over a community initiative and start layering in structure and putting in a bureaucracy to make it more efficient, you take the passion away. And I think a lot of the times these festivals and these pop-up events that we have throughout the city, when you take the passion away, it changes the character. And I think First Fridays is a great thing, but, you know, it in itself has morphed over the past few years.
Right. It's not so much an arts event. It's more of a festival now, street festival.
Exactly.
I know that the state of the schools was a priority for you during the campaign. What to you is the main thing City Hall should be addressing? Is it accountability? What is it exactly that we need to do to help fix our schools?
The schools are really that chicken or the egg. You know, what do you have to do in order to get a reaction? And is it you have to have the chicken in order to lay the egg, or you have to have the egg in order to raise the chicken? And it's one of those, I think, that we have to do much better job of demonstrating leadership and how we actually talk about our schools. You know, I sit there and I think, gosh, if we constantly are critical and criticizing instead of offering new solutions. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not going to get anywhere if all you say is blame, blame, blame. Mm-hmm. You're going to get somewhere if you say, okay, this is a problem, but here's one possible solution with these outcomes. Here's a second option with these outcomes, and here's a third option with these outcomes. And I think we've got to do more of that latter and getting our parents back into the schools and involved. You know, one of the examples that is a problem is we've got a problem with literacy in the city of Richmond. And yet our schools aren't sending books home to the parents to read to their kids at night to help with literacy because the schools say, well, we have a budget problem and those books probably aren't going to come back to the classroom if we send it home. Mm-hmm. But we got a literacy problem. Neither of those issues are resolving the fact that we have a literacy problem. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to kind of make that step toward, okay, getting the parents to take responsibility. 5-year-old might lose a book. It's okay. A 5-year-old's going to lose a book. Mm-hmm. Have the city make sure that we have enough resources available to accommodate mm-hmm. when these issues happen, but to make sure that there's this balance of accountability and resources.
Right. Well, we'll end here. This is a real basic political problem. Address the real infrastructure problem that the city has, namely potholes and dilapidating sidewalks. I don't see a plan to address it in the long term.
We have a huge backlog, and I think everybody's been pointing to this backlog of infrastructure. And we're collecting new fees, the stormwater fee, and yet 75% of our stormwater fee collection goes to a single project.
Right.
You know, that's not any sustainable solution. I think part of it, again, we might have a cost issue. You know, is the cost of maintaining this at the right balance, or are there more efficiencies that we should get? But at the same time, you know, I sit there and I think we're the capital of Virginia, and we provide all this great infrastructure for the capital, mm-hmm. and the city of Richmond pays for most of it, and the taxpayers of Richmond pay for most of it. And yet there's a larger percentage of the population that lives in the surrounding counties who benefit every day from the infrastructure that the city of Richmond citizens pay for. Mm-hmm. And there's a huge General Assembly that benefits every single day from the taxpayers of the city of Richmond.
Right.
And you sit there and you just think, okay, you know, we've talked about regional cooperation, but it's still, the burden is on the city.
Right.
And how can we better engage the General Assembly, make them recognize that Richmond is the capital, and that when their constituents from Floyd County come to visit, that they're coming to visit the capital,
mm-hmm.
and that they should see a capital city. They shouldn't see a city that is falling apart mm-hmm. and having all these vacant buildings and streets with huge potholes. They should take pride in the fact that Richmond is the capital of Virginia.
Well, I'm Don Harrison, and I've been speaking to Parker Agelasto. He's the incoming city council representative for Richmond's 5th District. Thanks for stopping by and talking with us on Open Source RVA.
Thanks, Don, for your time.
Is she really going out with him?
And that's Open Source RVA for Friday, November 16th. I'm Chris Dovey, and my co-hosts are Don Harrison and Amy Daniel. Our producers are Jay Westerman and Gabby Schatzi, and our board op is Rachel Solomon. Got a news tip? Email us at opensourcerva@gmail.com. Or visit us on the web at rvaopensource.com or at our Open Source RVA Facebook page. We'll be back next week, but until then, we hope you have a safe Thanksgiving with family, friends, and zero trans facts.
It's kind of strange, like a stormy sea. I don't know why, I don't know why. I guess these things have got to be. I've got a new rose, I've got a good. Yes, I knew that I always would. I can't stop to mess around. I got a brand new rose in town. See the sun, it shines. Don't get too close, or it'll burn your eyes. Don't you run away that way. You can come back another day. I've got a new rose, I've got a good. Yes, I knew that I always would. I can't stop to mess around. I got a brand new rose in town. I never thought this could happen to me. I feel so strange, oh why should it be? I don't deserve somebody this great. I got a good.